You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam,
Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo. At the beginning of each show, we will bring to your attention past creative works made by Indigenous artists, be that music, poetry, performance, or film, as our form of acknowledgement. You were just listening to the opening sequence of the 1969 film, These Are My People, co-directed by Roy Daniels, Willie Dunn, Michael Kanetakara Mitchell, and Barbara Wilson, members of the Indian film crew. This was the first National Film Board of Canada's film made entirely by an Indigenous crew. The 13-minute film is available to the public on the National Film Board's website. Please feel free to watch it there.
You're listening to Hail Discordia on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Recording in progress. Welcome to our radio show. This is called Hail Discordia with two exclamation marks.
We are co-hosts. I'm Sam.
And I'm Xinyue.
Xinyue, what is our program?
So this program is a translation, a loose translation based on a magazine called Discorder. And it is a magazine founded in 1983 by the UBC Library and then also the CITR radio station. And I was really surprised to find out about that information because in my mind, Discorder is a pretty young and dynamic magazine. And I first came into contact with it when my friend, who is a musician, was on the cover page of one of the issues. And how did you come to know about Discorder, Sam?
I graduated from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC. And I always knew that there was a radio station called CITR, but I never stepped foot inside the station or really engaged that much with it. But I knew that by the end of my degree, I really wanted to do storytelling work. So I got in touch with CITR and asked them how I could get involved in any way. And I heard about this emerging idea that a magazine was looking for some people to host a radio show, take their like articles from the magazine and turn them into sound pieces. And so that magazine was Discorder and the radio show is Hail Discordia, what you're listening to right now. So Xinyue and I got paired up as co-hosts and through this cosmically magical journey, we started Hail Discordia together with the partnership of Discorder magazine.
That's so interesting that you should say your interest was in storytelling. I guess it still is in storytelling because I'm also a practicing artist and I also use storytelling as a technique and strategy in my artwork. So I think if anything, it's the desire to tell stories that kind of united us together. And so could you tell us about how we're trying to build a platform for artists like us, or for what kind of show this is?
Yeah. So like Shinya said, we are taking articles from an already published magazine, a print magazine, and we're turning them into sound pieces. And so that's where we started. We started just as like taking already written articles and then try and experiment, like read the words aloud and add some sound effects and make them kind of like interactive ways of engaging with the magazine content. But as we kind of went along our journey, we started to interview actual artists who were featured in the magazine and for ourselves get firsthand experiences of these artists' perspectives and insights and expand conversations that you would read about in the magazine into a longer format. Mm-hmm. So what we both are so passionate about is the ability to engage with artists in real time and give them a platform to share about their work, share about their inspirations, share about things that they're observing in the world around them, and bring that all to you, listeners. If you are interested in music, poetry, films, or any other art medium, then this show is for you. And you could say maybe that's our mandate, is that we just want to create a home for artists to explore their craft and connect to their work and other artists' work more deeply. So our invitation to you listeners is come along on this journey, listen to our Discorder pieces that we turn into sound works, and you are welcome to reach out to us anytime and share your work or let us know if there are any really inspiring artists that we should be featuring on our show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for introducing our mandate as well. And I think on the different level, we're also concerned about social issues and social justice in general. And we want to stay updated with what is happening in our world. I think it's very ingrained in both of us that we want to use this opportunity to also shine a light on what's happening and what holds importance for both of us. So if you have ideas, philosophical questions, or just a desire to express yourself, you're also really welcome to come and then have a conversation with us. But we'll at the same time also continue to turn the published articles into soundscapes and sound works. So with that being said, I think we could dive into today's issue. And I'm just, one last thing I would like to say is that I really enjoyed collaborating with Sam. Like we said before, we don't really know each other before the show. So I'm glad to have known you.
It was so much fun to make it together. And I hope that other people enjoy it as much as we enjoyed making it.
Yellow River Blue is 40 minutes of pure listening pleasure. I found out about the album from a review in Discorder magazine and was immediately captivated by the reviewer's descriptive language. The review itself was written so well that it had me inspired to listen to the actual album, and what I found there was a colorful world. Coming to you straight from Hill Discordia, Thank you for tuning in, and enjoy this reading of Erica Enjo's review of Yellow River Blue by Yu Su, interspersed with Yu Su's music. Express train at Waterfront Station. My Spotify was playing Yu Su's Yellow River Blue, and I'm looking out the window. It captures the calm ocean and solemn mountains. Construction in front of nature. Colorless concrete blocks and those emotionless metallic shipping containers. One of the songs, Gleam, juxtaposes the sound of water dripping and the futuristic synthesizer. It perfectly matches this bizarre scenery where nature and the man-made coexist in a single frame, the window. The swirl of transparent, refreshing melodies. They're reminiscent of a beautiful river. It overlaps with the flow of the ocean in my sight, and I'm being swallowed into a haze. Yu Su is a Vancouver-based artist. She grew up in Kaifeng, China, the city facing the southern bank of the famous Yellow River. She moved to Vancouver to study at the University of British Columbia, where she became immersed in the underground techno scene. To spread techno music throughout China. She wants her music to encourage women in China to make music as well, as the genre remains extremely West. Her music can be described as Oriental techno. Oriental techno is an emerging genre that exhibits traditional Chinese melodies. It plays on the legacy of New Age or ambient music. Both of those genres often use Oriental sounds. New Age and ambient music actively practice the act of Western people taking from other cultures, all while claiming the sounds as Eurocentric. You wanted to see people recognize Chinese melody in electronic music. Yellow River Blue was digitally released in January of 2021 under Chinese label VA Records and the Amsterdam-based Music From Memory. Yu's initial plan was to release under a Western label, but after her visit to China and during the writing process, she decided to collaborate with VA Records. Yu's unswerving expression of her identity as Chinese is empowering to us. She's told me that she wants to be politically outspoken through her musical works. Coming from an East Asian family with a culture of not expressing their opinions until they have something solid, she seeks her own way of speaking up. Yu explains, "I want my work to speak for itself, because if my music is good, and you have to listen to it, I don't need any more words to tell you that you have to pay attention to an Asian woman making dance music." Yu plans to continuously follow her heart and make music purely in the way she wants, unfettered by the challenge of something new, in a future that refuses to be determined by someone else's expectations. Thank you for listening. This review was written by Erica Enjo and originally published in Discorder Magazine's April-May issue of 2021. The review was slightly shortened, reordered, and edited for clarity, and narrated by Samantha Llorente. Sound editing by Samantha Llorente. Music by Yu Su. The songs played in order were Xiu, that's X-I-U, Gleam, and Watermelon Woman. I highly recommend headphones.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
When it comes to a rainforest, the soundtrack is everything. sets the mood and it tells a story. Join me Tuesdays from 10 to 11 p.m. as I interview my guests about their seasons of life, and we listen to the soundtracks that went with them. You might learn a bit for your own seasons of life, and if nothing else, you'll find some great music. Tune in on 101.9 CITR FM Tuesdays from 10 to 11 p.m.
This upcoming piece is called Given Title, written and performed by Alex McLaren. This is his first published piece. We reflected on how we wanted to design the sound for this poem. In our initial talk, Alex sent us his Instagram page, at Nights Unlimited, which features 18 of his poems. He wakes up in the middle of the night, words pouring out of him, and he writes these poems. He doesn't know where they come from. It's almost as if his creative process is a stream of consciousness, always in the background, waiting to be activated in the depth of night. His poems on Instagram give me a sense that I'm about to be caught. Imagine black text against a white background, stripped down. Reading his posts allows your imagination to go wild. There's this lack of clarity about what's actually happening in the situations described in his poems. Yet this gives the reader space to fill in the blanks on their own. You're taken back to a time when you read Alex's work. Coming into adulthood, a feeling that you were never the same again after that one night, sensuality in the air, and your heart racing. We decided that we wanted this sound piece to reflect that stripped-down aesthetic that Alex does so well. So it is our pleasure to present Given Title, written and performed by Alex McLaren, sound editing by Samantha Llorente, originally published in print in Discorder Magazine's April-May 2021 issue. Music is by Christopher Moe Ditlevsen. The song is called Missing Memories.
We were all aboard a small novelty train as the guide laid my head in her lap. Of course I pointed backwards, ever fearful that my new and improved signature would not free me from the bonds I had created. But man, it looked good on that yellowed parchment. I suppose that's why we had a more relaxed attitude when they requested help. I was taking the ferry over that way. They need an extra body to help and wanted us there for 6. We left at 6. Prior to leaving, we checked out the open-air location shaped like a keyhole. As I received a complaint via the timeline, we pulled the truck along the side of the house. It barely fit. Lita stopped the truck to say goodbye. Again, we left late, and as we sped towards the terminal, I ate a chocolate-filled croissant that was covered in both chocolate spread and raspberries. To our chagrin, Mr. Brown called us. I reiterated we were on the way, which we were not. And then to my horror, he asked,
"What do you look like?"
Next on the radio is a review written by Alec Christensen. You are about to hear an abbreviated version of his film review on Maria Talla's documentary, You Are Not a Soldier, first published in Discorder magazine, June-July issue, 2021, followed by an interview. Be Being a spectator of calamities taking place in another country is a quintessential modern experience. The cumulative offering by more than a century and a half's worth of those professional, specialized tourists known as journalists, writes Susan Sontag in Regarding the Pain of Others, her tome on war photography. Wars are now also living room sights and sounds.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
Good evening. The deadline has come and gone. The Iraqis are living on what President Bush calls borrowed time.
Thanks to the coverage of the Gulf War by ABC, NBC, CBS, and the then nascent 24-hour CNN, images of war became widely available, no longer something one had to seek out. Far-off wars entered viewers' homes in an unprecedented way, albeit with a television screen as a border protecting them from any real danger. Social media dramatically increased this phenomenon, allowing journalists, citizen reporters, and activists to share photos and videos of conflict zones in real time.
It's a Central Park confrontation marked with racial undertones that's gone viral.
Please call the cops.
You call the police on an 8-year-old little girl. You can hide all you want. The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Maria Carolina tells You're Not a Soldier follows one of these specialized tourists, photojournalist Andrea Leon, almost exclusively through his own footage and photographs from the Libyan Civil War and the Battle of Mosul. Leon's footage of these conflict zones is unparalleled, largely due to its quasi-first-person point of view. We are essentially seeing what Leon sees, or at least what he points his camera at, as we move through these zones with him.
At that moment, for me, the sensation, the feeling of being there was something almost like kind of a religious thing.
Some extended sequences take place in Rome, where Leon's two young children live. Bose loathes his work and fails to understand what draws him to continually leave them to risk his life. In a particularly memorable exchange, his son tells him he has a shitty job. Leon takes this quite personally and speaks about it at length while shooting video during a night walk. He seems unable to understand why his children, despite their youth, would express disdain for his work.
No, work is shit. Probably it is shit. And you know, I'm probably going to die here with a car accident. A meaningless ruin.
These children almost act as audience surrogates, as Leon's dedication to his work does seem obsessive, quixotic, and even suicidal. In one sequence in Mosul, Leon and the soldier he is embedded with must traverse a destroyed building full of human corpses, unable to step around them all. This is perhaps the film's most difficult scene. It also is the one that most explicitly captures the tragedy that is war. While the footage itself is uniquely sobering and dispels any myth about nobility and war, the film seems disinterested in engaging with the ethical implications of shooting and viewing such horrors. Characterizing Leon as uniquely courageous, talented, and again, quixotic, strikes me as a fair portrayal. Yet this focus on him alone means that You're Not a Soldier ignores the fact that almost anyone has the ability to document and report on violence and injustice today. As I write this, my social media timelines are flooded with images and videos of atrocities and colonial violence committed by the Israeli military against Palestinians. Though this violence has been ongoing, social media has allowed journalists, activists, and everyday Palestinians to document and disseminate the horrors they are witnessing and experiencing in real time, defying the American, British, and Israeli narratives that have dominated discourses and excuse or surprise the violence. With the dissemination comes not only a greater chance of consequences and justice, but also broader political change. Sontag notes that these images make real or more real matters that the privileged and the merely safe might prefer to ignore. Through these images, distant wars are made close, uncomfortable truths revealed, and forgotten or surprised crimes and tragedies remembered. You Are Not a Soldier trades a broader consideration of the crucial and extremely urgent ethical and political dimensions of capturing, distributing, and viewing images of violence for a safer and fairly straightforward profile in Courage. Its most difficult and richest question remain peripheral. Not that it owes viewers any clear answers given the complexity of the topic. Unfortunately, however, the film leaves us how it found us, unsure how to best navigate a world that constantly exposes us to representations of violence while further subjecting us to them.
You're listening to Hail Discordia on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
For the next section, Sam and I invited the author of the review, Alec Christensen, to sit down with us and talk about the documentary, his own work on film studies, and thoughts on militainment.
We can start by perhaps having you introduce yourself for our listeners. So are you working on some projects, and can you tell us a bit about your projects?
Yeah, so right now I'm a master's student at UBC. In the cinema and media studies program. In broad terms, I'm kind of researching how Hollywood depicts the global South, looking right now at kind of a multitude of regions and considering how they are depicted in different films and in television and other forms of media. In terms of current projects, I'm kind of in between things. But recently this summer, I presented on The African Queen at a conference talking about how that film and some of the texts made about it, so memoirs and documentaries and other fiction films about the African Queen, kind of all explore a similar idea, which is this notion that self-discovery can only happen by leaving the comforts of the West. Self-discovery for Westerners, I should say, only happens when they leave the West and can only be found in the so-called Orient or the East or the South or some other place or some foreign place.
So you wrote this film review about You Are Not a Soldier. What motivated you to write the interview?
Well, I just get excited anytime Discorder has film content because it doesn't happen super often, right? Despite like the prevalence of film in Vancouver, I think the magazine, and this is not a criticism at all, it just tends to be more about like music and arts, right? Just knowing Doxa was happening and seeing there was a chance to talk write about movies got me really excited. You Are Not a Soldier stood out to me though, in particular, just because it was kind of a documentary approach to what I usually study through fiction films. So I thought it would be a little interesting to kind of get outside my primary focus, but still explore a topic that I'm interested in and passionate about.
So going back to the film and the film review, could you tell us about your relationship with the film?
Yeah, so I got to watch it through a screener link, ironically with my parents when I was visiting them, which was not exactly like the greatest like Friday night, like let's sit down and watch a movie option available. I think there were a lot of issues with it and a lot of things I found that it did that were interesting and different from what I would expect a documentary like this to be. I think there's this kind of weird relationship within the film between Andre Leon and the film text itself, because he's credited as the director of photography, which makes sense because so much of the footage was shot by him, because he seems just to be like a man who films every part of his life. So we see him, yes, like filming war zones and being filmed in and around war zones, but we also see him filming his interactions with his kids. We see him film him saying goodbye to his kids, We see him film what seems a little bit like a nervous breakdown, or just like a bit of a panic attack, as he's out walking around Rome at night, pondering his relationship with his family and his job and the implications of his work. But then it's just interesting that instead of saying maybe footage by Andre Leon or something, they credit him with director of photography, because that's obviously a position that implies some sort of like creative control over the film, right? Like they usually are controlling the visual look of a film. Similarly, it was unclear whether the subject of the film was war photography or Leon the man, right? And like, I think the answer surely is both, right? Like both are central to the film, but it gets to these kind of weird and horrifying moments where you're seeing real footage of dead, mutilated, broken bodies from war zones, but those scenes are used then to reflect Leon's characterization almost. So it'd be one thing if we were seeing these like awful images, these sickening images, to teach us something about war and violence and even photography, but it just becomes kind of weird and perverse when then this shows us Andre's trauma, right? So these, I think I said in our pre-interview, these bodies almost become props. And the images are certainly affective with an A, and they certainly like do prompt horror and disgust, but it's just the way it's used is so strange and, again, like kind of perverse, I think.
I understand exactly what you mean. And then I too was just really confused by where this film really wanted to position us. And I think to a certain extent, there is a little voyeuristic quality to it by the way that, you know, the bodies were displayed on screen, and also the way that Leon's footage, it's being edited. And I think it was, you quoted Susan Sontag, and in her essay, she used Simone Weil's quote. And then she says that violence turns anybody subjected to it into a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that sensation was really strong. I felt like I couldn't really see the people in the film as real people. They're just moving objects. And Leon, his positionality was also unclear. At times he was speaking to the camera as if the camera was his friend or companion. So I was wondering if he was given some prompts to talk about his experience in this, or I had this really strange vision that this is who he is. This is what he is. He just is this person that wanders by himself all alone in the night and talking into a camera, because that somehow was the entirety of his identity.
I think it's interesting just to consider like the role of the camera in the film, right? Because the camera is obviously, it's our lens into it, so we're intimately tied to the camera. But the camera is always in the hands of Leon or on him. So we only get to experience this world through him. Not this world, it's our world, but we only get to experience the film and it's like milieu through him. And it is really interesting, and it's like I don't want to speculate on like his psychology or anything, but and I don't want to talk about him like a character, because like he's also a real person, but it does seem like he's almost incapable of processing the world without the camera, at least as he's like kind of characterized in this film. Because, you know, if in like a normal documentary, there would probably be like talking heads and like a sit down interview, right, with him, and we would maybe see that interjected throughout the film, or he would have some sort of narration or whatever. But this is quite unique in that his narration and his input almost seems like unprompted, long, unscripted rants, right? Like, we don't know where this scene of him walking around Rome at night shooting himself with the camera. We don't know where he's going. He's on the verge of, like, he's crying. And it just sounds like someone who's like severely unwell, kind of going on a rant, you know, which is totally justified given the horrors he's seen and the nature of his job. But it's such a unique kind of way for a documentary to get inside the head of its subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you described Leon in your writing as quixotic, obsessive, and sometimes suicidal. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely agree. And you, there's another word that you use that I really love. It's surrogate. So I think Leon is almost, to me, a surrogate for the audience. He kind of speaks to this idea of entering a zone full of danger and violence, and he becomes this symbolic thing where he brings home an experience. And then I think that speaks to the voyeuristic quality that I was talking about. As a viewer, we're witnessing Leon both as a spectator and as a spectrum. So he is the one filming something, but he's also being filmed. He's being edited into another medium, another format. And I think that relationship is really kind of difficult for me to grapple with. And then that ambiguity is further enhanced when the film director actually provided this prose-like and very poetic reading of his action. And in that scene, one of the narration was followed right after a footage of Leon's children, and then she speaks to her own father. So I felt like she was, in a way, putting herself in the shoes of his children and thinking about Leon both as a father and as a martyr that goes without thinking about his own life. And there's something beautiful and poignant about it, but it's also dangerous because we don't know exactly what is giving us, what is providing, what is he pursuing. I wonder what's your thought on that.
Yeah, I think it has a very uncanny like literary quality to it, right? With those like poem prose readings by the director. And it's just, it's an interesting way for her to like insert her own perspective into the film in a rather like explicit way.
Alguns dias depois disso, você foi embora, pai. Quando você perde alguém que você ama demais, eu acho que você tem que se reinventar.
Going back to just what I, all the words I used to describe him, I like obviously mean no like offense. It's just an analysis of like how he's portrayed in this film. There is a quixotic element to him, right, where I feel like, I don't know, you or I, like if we were photographers and now we suddenly have kids, it's like, okay, maybe I have something anchoring me here. I don't want to go over there where I could die. I don't want to leave my children on like what seems like a death wish sometimes. And it is really interesting, the relationship with the daughter, especially because the son is a little too young to fully understand maybe everything going on. But the way the director positions herself in the daughter's like shoes almost, with this interesting like pairing of this young girl watching her dad constantly leave for something she doesn't understand, and then the real life director talking about her recently dead father who always longed to or whose biggest life regret was not fighting in World War II. I think it's interesting you use the word dangerous to describe that. Do you want to like expand on that? On that relationship or that insertion as being maybe dangerous? I don't disagree. I'm just curious to know more why that was the word you would choose.
Well, yes. Why are you interviewing me?
Tables are turned.
Back in my comfortable position. You've been listening to Discorder Radio.
Yeah. I think it's the blurring of the line that is particularly dangerous to me. Because it kind of, instead of focusing on Leon as a character, there is a transformation of turning your audience into a character, or just, I guess, upset their positionality. Like, I wasn't sure if at that point I was simply comfortably sitting in my chair and watching a film. Like, I felt like I was invited into a dialogue, but with whom? Talking about what? I wasn't really clear.
I think it's a very interesting experimental, like, or just very interesting experiment for Telles to like do with this film, right? Is this idea of like disrupting the audiences and the directors and the subject, like positionality when watching a documentary, right? like you said, to make the audience a character, to make the subject a character almost, but also a collaborator, to make yourself as director also a bit of a character, but also kind of a omniscient narrator, right? And like, or God, because she's obviously like controlling what the film is going to be. I think that's a really interesting experiment, and I'd like love to see more of that. And I think I wish it didn't have to be in the context of real violence and real mass death, obviously, because I think something like that deserves to be the center of attention.
On that note of making war closer to our reality, would you mind talking a little bit about the concept of militainment?
Militainment mainly comes up in this book by Roger Stahl, and it's essentially this idea of military-themed entertainment forms. So this isn't just movies featuring soldiers, but also video games, action figures, reality television, all entering like domestic spaces. Oh, and cable news too, that's obviously a big one. So that's militainment. I think like easy examples to point to are is a film like Top Gun, which was collaborated on, or the Navy like collaborated in the making of that film. And that film was like proven to have increased recruitment after it came out. You could get movies like Michael Bay, which have some sort of like techno fetishism in it. There's a lot of In Michael Bay movies, there's often a break from the central action to show like military technology and soldiers getting ready to fight, which get almost as much emphasis as like the actual fighting. And then I think like the biggest one is Call of Duty, which of course is one of like the highest grossing video game series ever. It allows you to play as like various like soldiers in real and fictional conflicts. It lets you play against people online using, again, real and fictional and futuristic military technology. And again, like we know the U.S. military has like a real relationship with the makers of Call of Duty, helping inform like the look of things in the game, but also the Army like has used video games like Call of Duty, like one that they actually funded called America's Army, to recruit, but also to like help train and simulate like combat experiences. So that's militainment. And a bit of a rambling definition. The one other like kind of important thing to know with it is that militainment often decontextualizes war from its like historic and political contexts and origins to focus mainly on like individual or groups of soldiers, and tell like stories of like heroism and valor. So it doesn't want you to question why these conflicts are happening by any means. It just wants you to accept that they are happening, but then you can admire these like acts of courage and bravery happening within them.
Thank you so much for all of those examples, because I think it helps also clarify some things about militainment for myself. And You Are Not a Soldier, it doesn't like appear that the film is trying to make this depiction of war a form of entertainment. But it still begs the question, how might militainment show up in You Are Not a Soldier or the making of it?
I don't know, kind of maybe what I mentioned a couple minutes ago about this like simulation aspect of those scenes that are kind of resemble like a first person perspective, where we're just looking through the camera as someone holding it is running around a battlefield, and there's gunfire, there's explosions. And it's hard to make anything out, but it like, we'd be lying if we said those scenes weren't harrowing and, I don't know, to some, and I don't say this to like shame anyone, but maybe even exciting, right? Because it's an unparalleled look at conflict. Yeah, I think it's unfair to the movie to say it's militainment, because I think it's certainly critical of the way that war is often portrayed, even if it has its own issues in its depiction of war. But I think one reason it made me think of militainment was just those sequences that do have like a harrowing aspect to them, and especially the way they segue from this harrowing aspect, or this, again, excitement, such a like a dirty word to use here, but excitement, to then a far more somber and horrifying like sequence of real dead bodies of civilians, and it kind of merges those together and makes you look at the conflict of, or the side of conflict that isn't often portrayed in other like media forms, especially fictional ones. I think it does like kind of successfully dispel some myths and some ideas we have about what war looks like.
You used the word decontextualizing. Was that the word? Earlier when you talked about militantment. I think I have some thoughts on that as well, in terms of how the war that is being depicted in this film is decontextualized. And then instead of making us realize the atrocity of the war, we were made simply spectators of something exciting. And you use that word and you said it makes you feel dirty or like almost shameful to say this is, you know, stimulating, but it is. And it is such an interesting question in its own, because why is this thing so stimulating? And then I think thinking about the history of filmmaking or photography, there's always this aspect of novelty in it. Mm-hmm. You know, we wanted to see something that is entirely different from our own life. And then I think we really need to examine the existence of films and photography or media like this that depicts something that is really graphic and horrific, but it provides a sense of entertainment, right? And I think the film on its own is a form of militantment almost. So it's not just about the character, not just about the person, but the very existence of this film speaks to our fascination for violence and for war. And I think maybe historically we were repelled, or war photography is there to remind us that there is something so sinister and evil about human behavior. But now there is an oversaturation of images like that. Mm-hmm. And then have you thought about our spectatorship in this? Like, who are we in this narrative? Like, what are we when we're watching films or even just talking about a film like this on radio?
Yeah, it is like, it's tough and it's weird and uncomfortable. And yeah, there is definitely like a saturation of images of real violence, right? Like in the review, I even mentioned how, though like often traumatic to watch, these images have like prompted or exacerbated like global change and global movements. The example I gave in the review was the cell phone footage of George Floyd's murder, and how that, partly because it was so widely circulated and widely accessible, forced a lot of people to finally stop pretending that police violence against Black people was not its own pandemic, right? Its own prevalent injustice. So I think it's wrong to say there's no value to these images, and like it's important to stress that they're traumatic and they're not things I think anyone should ever be forced to watch, but there is power to them, even if that power is often unclear. I think one issue with the Floyd comparison, however, though, or the video of that murder, is that was obviously like a domestic crime, right? That was like a domestic murder, whereas images of war are set in foreign places. So I think the people who might view them might just care less, because it's further away. It's easier to disassociate yourself from this violence, right? Even if you're living in the country that's perpetuating so much of it, or at least participating in it. So it's tough. Like, I think the oversaturation of it is its own concern, because I think becoming desensitive to these things is also an issue, right? If we are so exposed to violence that it becomes a part of everyday life, which I think you could make a valid argument that might be the case where we're at now, we're not going to want to do anything to respond to it. But at the same time, if we don't have the ability to see what real violence looks like, I think it might also be hard to remember that it's happening.
I think that we've talked a lot about
the creators of content or about the content being created and the implications of it. And I think we've talked a little bit too about the experience of being a viewer, but I do think that the audience or people who, audience isn't a great word to be honest, people who see this media, they see these photographs and videos in the news, or they see it on social media, or they see it in films, just in pop culture. What is the role of these viewers in terms of what you do with this information that you're viewing about things that are happening local to you or in faraway places? Because I think that it's an important question of how we process this content. And I do think that it makes a difference in its role in our lives.
I hope that the passivity that with that we consume fictional films with is eradicated with when the artifice or the fiction is as well. So I hope with real violence there is disgust and there is horror, and I hope that people and activists and people capable of empathy can wield that range of emotions to campaign against the violence or to resist the violence. And like, it's hard, right? Like, we don't know what, like when you watch You Are Not a Soldier, it doesn't really give you with much you can do, right? It's not giving you an instruction manual on how to stop violence. But yeah, like hopefully people who see these images and have reactions that are marked by disgust and sadness and horror can hopefully wield those emotions to combat these conditions. And you know, if you look at how like violence like intersects, right? And you think about how colonial violence against like racialized others abroad relates to domestic violence against racialized like domestic citizens, and you see how those relate and come from the same ideas and ideals, maybe when you see images of violence abroad, it can at least inspire you to resist violence at home.
Well, you left us on a pretty hopeful note. So these images don't really just simply incapacitate you. It doesn't make you feel completely powerless. There's something to be said about what kind of activism it can trigger.
I think so. And like, you know, I think the reality is not every viewer who feels disgust is going to do something about it, right? Like, I wrote about the movie. I don't know what material change that's going to prompt in the world. But I don't know, those images like have stuck with me and have made me more cognizant of the things I research and the pervasiveness of militing and like colonial propaganda and things like that, you know, so.
And I do think that one material change that your review did is that we're having this conversation today, which wouldn't have happened unless we both, Shinya and I, read that review. So it's interesting to bring it back to like these conversations or these thoughts that we sometimes put out there in the form of writing or you know, talking. I do think that they have effects. It does open the conversation to a topic that, for myself personally, I never thought I'd be critically thinking about.
I think with that, the conversation is coming to a resolved place. I don't know if we've resolved this topic.
I don't think we've resolved think it's much. Very I think we've just pointed out more problems, which I think is what we do in the humanities. We don't fix the problems. We just identify them and trust them to smarter people than us.
And come up with even more questions to make it a little more confusing.
Yeah, we don't want it to be easy.
Thank you so much, Alec, for doing this. Thank you for coming to the show. This is the first ever episode, and we're just very, very excited to have you and for this really exciting, stimulating discussion that we just had. So,
yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been an honor.
You're listening to Hail Discordia on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.